Hello and welcome to The Print. And in today's interview, we have a very special guest, Professor David Reich. He's an American geneticist, and his research on the population genetics of ancient humans has significantly furthered our understanding about where we came from and about modern humans. So we're going to be spending a few questions with him to understand his decades long of research. Thank you for joining us, Professor Reich. Professor Reich, I'm going to immediately start off with a very immediate question. You just published a paper on the origins of the Indo-European language, and it sort of fills like this big missing puzzle that we had about where a lot of the languages came from. Could you tell our viewers a little bit about what those findings were and how significant those are?
Sure. So just for the viewers, a little quick history of what the Indo-European languages are. More than 200 years ago, it was discovered that a vast array of languages spoken by almost half the world's population descend from a common root maybe 6,000 or 7,000 years ago. This was a shock more than 200 years ago, and it includes almost all languages in Europe, like Greek and Latin and German languages, including English, and also Armenian language, Northern Indian languages, and Iranian languages. And there's been a huge breakthrough in DNA research beginning in 2015 that I had the privilege of being involved in, which showed that almost all spoken languages, Indo-European languages, almost certainly derive from an expansion of people after 5,000 years ago from the steppes north of the Black and Caspian Seas. Some of the first pastoralists, herders, and their descendants then likely spread these languages. And the branching patterns of the descendants match the branching patterns of the languages, more or less. So that was known in the last few years, but the big, deepest question, which was the origin in the homeland of the people who first spoke these languages, wasn't understood because the deepest branching language is Anatolian language. It's the language spoken by people like the ancient Hittites, whose language was known not from anybody speaking it today, but inscribed on tablets that were discovered by archaeologists in the last 100 years. And these languages are clearly Indo-European, and yet they don't have any DNA from these Yamnaya steppe pastoralists. So what we did in our paper was found the population that's ancestral both to the Yamnaya and to these people like the Hittites. And this is a population that lived on the northern slopes of the Caucasus Mountains. It's the biggest mountain range in Europe. And to the lower Volga River, it's a region about the size of California. And people were moving back and forth that in that region between 7,000 and 5,500 years ago. And most of the ancestry and the DNA of the Yamnaya comes from them, about 80%. 10 to 30% of the DNA of the people that have been sampled from Hittite regions comes from them. And this is likely the missing link. These people likely spoke Indo-European languages. They shared some cultural elements that we can recover from the archaeology, certain ways of burying their dead, for example. And it's from these people that the Yamnaya then spread, and then the Yamnaya spread further and produced a group called the Corded-ware. And from them, the Corded-ware then spread, and the Corded-ware is the ancestor of 99% of the speakers of present-day Indo-European languages.
Professor Reich, you've also done a lot of study on India's evolutionary cycle. Could you tell us how India's evolutionary patterns have been different from the rest of the world? Because if you compare Indians to, say, Europeans or Africans, we sort of look different even, from north to south. So what has been your studies based in India been like, and what are the findings, and how different is the pattern of India as opposed to the rest of the world?
Sure. So I've written many papers on Indian population history. It's been one of my deepest interests, even though I'm not Indian myself. And maybe I'll answer your question in a little bit of a kind of tendentious way by saying, in a lot of ways, India's history is similar to that of other parts of the world. In particular, it's parallel to the history of Europe. So both of these places I often think of as two subcontinents of Eurasia, about the same size historically, on average, about the same population, complicated places. And each of them is formed of three very different source populations. So in Europe, it's the local indigenous hunter-gatherers, the farmers who come in after about 8,000 years ago, and it's these pastoralists from the steppe north of the Black and Caspian Seas. And they mix in different proportions over 8,000 years to form the people living in Europe today. In India, it's the indigenous hunter-gatherers, just the same, these ancestral South Indians who are related to Andamanese and related to Southeast Asians. And it's the probably the farming population that brings Middle Eastern farming to India after about 5,000 years ago. These are Iranian related genetically, although not necessarily from Iran, but perhaps related from Iran. And it's the steppe descended people. And these three come together in a parallel way to form people in India today. Of course, there's also profound differences. What you see in South Asia is that there's these mixing of these groups. And in particular, the steppe ancestry is mixed in a smaller proportion than it is in Europe. It probably brings the languages that connect India to northern India, to Europe, and to Armenia, and so on, the Indo-European languages. But the proportion of this DNA is smaller, no more than 20% from the Yamnaya, whereas it can go up to 50% or more in Europe. And the mixing is very profound between 4,000 and 3,000 years ago, and even 2,000 years ago, and then it stops. And the reason it stops is that the caste system develops, and we see the caste system arising in the liturgical texts. Parallel to that, you see evidence in the genetics that people, at least some groups, stop mixing very much with their neighbors. And so that's a feature that's common in India. It's not an age-old feature. It's not eternal. It happened beginning 2 or 3,000 years ago, resulted in the massive population mixture that had occurred before between very different groups, freezing and becoming relatively little mixture and preserving some of that population substructure from a couple of thousand years ago.
Professor Raik, in your previous interviews and even in a lot of the papers that you've written, you've spoken about ancient North, ancient South, but there is a population in India, in central India, like the Patels, etc., that you've spoken about, have a very different cycle of progression that they have followed. Could you tell us a little about that? Like, you know, could that be traced to Europe, like you said, like some of the North Indian population is?
I think there's relatively little direct migration from Central Europe, for sure. I think that the only major European ancestry I'm aware of that has entered India is about some proportion of European farmer ancestry via the corded ware culture through a series of steppe cultures that get squeezed into India between 4,000 and 3,500 years ago. There are groups in India, most groups in India can be relatively well described statistically, with exceptions, as mixtures between two very divergent ancestral populations, the ancestral North Indians and the ancestral South Indians. But there are people who are not well described by that. Many of the groups that speak Austroasiatic languages, the Munda groups, and also Tibeto-Burman languages, don't fit in that simple model. Some people who are traditionally priestly status in northern India, like Brahmins and Bhumihars, don't fit perfectly on that model often. And there's other specific groups like the Patels, for example, that don't fit perfectly and have some additional input. It's not that they don't have lots of DNA from the same sources. Most of their DNA is. It's just there's additional influences. You see this in Europe, too. There's groups that are well described by the three-source model. And then there's that have additional impacts, Greeks, for example, Hungarians, for example. There are specific groups that have specific histories that are often mappable and connectable to specific events in the past.
Professor, some of your findings have also sort of established how our genes, the modern humans, sort of still carry some traces of the Neanderthals. Could you tell us a little bit about how these traces sort of impact, you know, our day-to-day function, our health patterns, and, you know, how we sort of behave in different climatic conditions? And how is it going to, can we still see the traces of ancient humans as we go forward in the evolutionary cycle?
Yeah, so about 2% of the DNA of non-Africans in Eurasia comes from Neanderthals, and an additional small percentage comes from in Eastern and Southern Asia, comes from Denisovans, this other archaic group of humans. And in Australia and New Guinea, a much larger proportion comes from, like, close to 3 or 4% comes from Denisovans as well. And it's part of our DNA. So it does stuff, like all the rest of our DNA. So it's inseparable from our DNA, and does all sorts of things. So we and others have studied some of the functions of these variants. And for example, the Denisovan genetic variants, sorry, the Neanderthal genetic variants are unusually important in skin and hair biology. So maybe a hypothesis, it's not proven, is that they might have been helped people to adapt. They might have been, Neanderthals might have been pre-adapted to some of the colder Eurasian environments that anatomically modern humans hadn't encountered in Africa. And so maybe these skin and hair adaptations could have been valuable, and they could have been picked up and retained. Maybe that's a hypothesis that might be the case. Certain other variants, like in the high altitude adaptation that Tibetans have, that clearly comes from Denisovans. There were Denisovans in Tibet, we now know from ancient protein sequencing.
Professor, you were also speaking about how something as recent as COVID and our adaptation in response to it was also could also be a response to what we carry from the ancient humans. Could you
very quickly? So the highest risk factor for severe COVID-19 is a variant that was identified in mapping studies mostly in Europeans, but it's pretty rare in Europeans. But the variant's more common in South Asia. That's the group in the world that's most common. It makes people likely to get a much more severe form of COVID-19. Most people don't have it, maybe, but some people do, and those people are more susceptible to a severe form of COVID-19. And that's a variant that arose in Neanderthals and comes in from this interbreeding. So it's an example of how millions of deaths seem to be potentially due to some variant that we get from Neanderthals.
Coming to my last question, Professor Reich, what are you currently working on, and what do you see of us as modern humans? How much of the evolutionary cycle do we currently understand, and how much of it is still a secret?
I think that really we know so much more about some places in the world than others. The degree to which we have a rich understanding of European history is not matched by any other part of the world. So one of the really exciting directions to go is to apply this technology in all different parts of the world to try to understand in rich detail the movement of people and how past archaeological cultures relate to each other and to subsequent cultures. That's an amazing thing to be able to do, and I'd love to be involved in that. And another thing that would be really exciting to be able to do would be to begin to understand the biological function of these genetic variants. That's also something that we're working on a lot. Yeah.
Thank you, Professor Reich. Thank you for speaking to us.
Thank you.